Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. I've been long interested in the financial world and global economics, in finance, in credit, monetizing everything under the sun and how things work. And I must say that I have come across a book that you really all need to read. It's called Crisis by Design, A Look Behind the Wizard's Curtain. It's also being made into a movie. The author is Bruce Wiseman, a former banker, a writer, and he's a wonderful man that has laid out the architecture and details of how, in fact, the economy was designed to fall apart. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to It's Rainmaking Time, a very tough subject to talk about, Bruce Wiseman. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, many people have been complaining about the economy, blaming the subprime mortgages, different people in power, blaming the Fed, blaming the insurance industries, the people that do the ratings for insurance, blaming the stock market, blaming the banks. There's a lot of upset and pain, and people really don't understand the intricacy of the puzzle that you seem to unlock in your book, Crisis by Design. Talk to us about what made you write this.
Well, thanks. That's a good summary. And the answer to your question is kind of focused on the or embraced in the title of the book, which is Crisis by Design, meaning, and sometimes it's a little hard for people to confront, but I think if they read the material in the book, they can see it, that this financial crisis actually was designed. The purpose of the financial crisis, very specifically, was to take down the United States and the United States dollar as the stable point in international finance and to replace them with what was referred to as a GMA, a Global Monetary Authority. And this gets to your question, because in March of 2008, I read an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, written by the then president of the New York Fed, calling for a GMA. Now, as you mentioned, I'm a former banker and have been in the world of finance and investment and credit and banking for many, many years. And I had never heard this term. But a global monetary authority is basically a financial dictator for the planet. And my alarm bells went off. I had been following the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank for many years. And when the president of the New York Fed comes out and calls for a global monetary authority, as I say, my antennas went up. I started researching and I started writing. As those of your listeners that follow such things would know, the president of the New York Fed in March of 2008 was Timothy Geithner, who is now the Secretary of the Treasury. And in fact, last April, Kim, April 2nd, at the G20 meeting in London, a global monetary authority was put in place.
Wait, did you say put in place?
Yes, put in place. Not much fanfare. A press release was put out, but the leaders of the G20 nations signed an agreement, a communique, which established an entity called the Financial Stability Board. Very Soviet-sounding name, Financial Stability Board, which is located in the Bank for International Settlements, which is in which is in Basel, Switzerland. This bank, which was Hitler's bank, I hasten to add, has its own territory in Switzerland. It is not subject to Swiss law. Its employees are immune from any kind of prosecution. They have their own police force on the property. It's almost like the Vatican in terms of, I don't like to position the Bank for International Settlements with the Vatican, but just from the sense of political autonomy, that bank is a universe unto itself, and it is the central banker's central bank. So central banks, the listeners are probably familiar with the Fed, the United States Federal Reserve Bank. That's our central bank. Virtually every industrialized country has a central bank, and they are all, interestingly, members of the Bank for International Settlements. So this new body that was established last April now essentially has command authority over all the central banks on the planet. And why that's important is because central banks create currency. So if you control the money, the monetary supply, you essentially control the country.
But don't you think that a lot of people have a perception that the IMF controls the currencies anyway? And so if they think the IMF controls the currencies, what would be an issue with the Financial Stability Board, for example?
Well, the IMF does affect currencies, but they have the IMF doesn't give direct orders to the central banks. International Monetary Fund and the Financial Stability Board are working very closely now, but the Financial Stability Board is actually the senior organization because, again, if you can dictate to the central banks, you're basically controlling the money supply. The IMF is onerous in other ways in that it goes in, helps create economic catastrophes, and then comes in kind of on a white horse after they or somebody that's connected to them causes these catastrophes and, says to the president or dictator or prime minister in some third world country, gee, you having a problem? Would $5 or $10 billion help? And the president goes, sure, and the IMF goes, sign here. And so these countries become indebted to the IMF. I have read these loan agreements. They would stand the hair up on the back of your neck. They provide control over education, agricultural policy, tax policy, reproductive policy.
Probably land rights.
Yes. So
minerals.
Yes. So these are not nice guys. These are international bankers that have been eating up the planet like some kind of Darth Vader Pac-Man. But to control the currencies on the planet, that job has been turned over to the Financial Stability Board. And when you read the authorities that have been given to the Financial Stability Board, again, just last April, again, not highly publicized, but this information is available, and it's in the book. You'll see what has happened because the subtitle of the book, "Crisis by Design: The Untold Story of the International Financial Coup," and this was a coup. This financial crisis was a setup, and it was a coup. And the authority for planetary finance now resides in Basel, Switzerland.
Didn't it always with the Bank for International Settlements? It basically. One and two.
Well, these guys have not, been good guys. I mean, as I mentioned, this was Hitler's bank. They facilitated the transfer of Nazi gold during the Second World War. They have a very fascist pedigree.
Do all central banks have to be a member of the Bank for International Settlements?
I think if you're going to, I actually don't know the answer to that question in the sense that I don't know if it's mandated, but I think if you're going to, transfer funds between countries and so forth, the Bank for International Settlements facilitates that. I mean, the truth of the matter is that's something that's needed. So some organization has to do it. There are 55 members, Kim, 55 central banks that are members of the Bank for International Settlements, and these are, essentially the central banks of the industrialized nations in the world.
In your book, you talk about several important instruments that I think the public should have a frame of reference for what they are. One is the Community Reinvestment Act. The other one is the Glass-Steagall Act, and there's a couple of more, but can you explain those two?
Sure.
I read your book. I know what they are, but explain it to the public.
Yeah, the first article in the book, and the book is really a compendium of articles that I wrote after I was researching this financial crisis as it was occurring. And you can see how, among other things, Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Fed, held suppressed interest rates down intentionally and pushed, along with others, the Community Reinvestment Act. The Community Reinvestment Act, had a humanitarian-sounding purpose, which was to facilitate homeownership. But in fact, it mandated that loans be given to, unqualified borrowers, frankly. And the Fed pushed that very, very strongly on banks. If a bank was going to, particularly if a bank was going to get new branches, they have to apply to the Fed. If they were not in compliance with the Community Reinvestment Act, meaning giving out lots of loans to essentially low-income borrowers, then their application for new branches and that kind of thing could be, you know, kind of put on hold. Over time, the Fed more and more aggressively began, pushing banks very, very hard to make these low-income loans. So, this is going on in the 90s, and you start getting this flood of, subprime mortgages, a term we've all heard of. These subprime mortgages were then, a lot of people know now, were packaged up in packages called collateralized debt obligations,
CDOs,
or mortgage-backed securities, just kind of fancy names for packages of mortgages, and then investment banks, sold them all over the planet. The other act that you mention is tied into this because during the Depression there was a law passed called the Glass-Steagall Act, which said a commercial bank could not be the same as an investment bank. A commercial bank being like Wells Fargo or B of A or any of the banks that take deposits, an investment bank being something like Goldman Sachs or Lehman Brothers or what have you. Investment banks basically invest in stock or promote stocks and do those kinds of investments.
Stocks and bonds and securities.
Yes.
Okay.
So the Glass-Steagall Act was passed because they didn't want banks taking depositors' monies and gambling with them in the stock market or the bond market or the currency markets. And it kept those two kinds of institutions separate for 70 years. Along comes Greenspan and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, who's now hanging out in the Obama White House, and they basically undid that law. They
repealed it.
They took it off the books, which is a very difficult thing to do, I hasten to add. I mean, getting a law through Congress is tough. Getting one off the books is even tougher. They lobbied at the highest levels, and they got that removed, which enabled commercial banks and investment banks to become one. And so these packaging of subprime mortgages was something that an investment bank could do within its own structure. And you have, for instance, Goldman Sachs packaging these things up and selling them off, Citigroup doing it, and several other investment banks in Wall Street. So it was when you kind of look at the sequence of things, and there's another article in the book, another chapter in the book, which actually talks about an earlier beginning to these real estate mortgages. But that's what those two acts did, and that's how they were involved in this mess.
So it creates the opening and the instrumentation for everything that we are seeing now.
Yes.
And experiencing now.
Yes, it provided channels so that could occur. That's correct.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. No matter what the state of the economy is, there will always be time-honored traditions and special events. The Sterling Hut has been in business since 2008, offering a wide range of fantastic sterling silver products, including finely crafted mint julep cups, personalized baby shower gifts, photo albums, exquisite jewelry boxes and awards, and so much more. The Sterling Hut is an authorized Silver Star international reseller of fine silver products and anniversary gifts. The business is owned by Jewel and Bob Howard. If you would be interested in buying someone a gift of pure sterling silver or sterling plated silver, you can call 1-888-819-1009. Get a 15% discount by going to the Sterling Hut, the Sterling, S-T-E-R-L-I-N-G, Hut, H-U-T.com, and saying it's rainmaking time. They will honor a 15% discount for you. Beautiful sterling silver gifts for all of life's occasions. manufactured in Italy and handcrafted by skilled artisans. They can also be engraved in sterling picture frames, oval and rectangular silver trays, champagne ice buckets, silver goblets, coffee and tea service, coffee pots, silver mugs, candelabras, and silver jewelry unrivaled in design and style. Go to the Sterling Hut at sterlinghut.com. And back to the show. You speak about another instrument called the waiver of capital requirements being a critical key in how this whole thing has been empowered and designed to happen.
Yeah, well, interestingly, the head of Goldman Sachs in, I forget the exact date, I don't have it in my head, but as this as these subprime mortgages were rolling forward, the head of Goldman Sachs went to the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and this is this relationship between the New York Fed and the New York banks is extremely incestuous. You know, it's like the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA. I mean, they're just buddies. And they went in there, and there were certain capital requirements that the investment banks were supposed to maintain, which kept their lending leverage down. In other words, to make it simply understood, the more capital that the bank had to have on hand, the safer it was in case something went bad. They had capital reserves to fall back on. But the head of Goldman Sachs, a name that will become infamous in 21st century history, Henry Paulson, who later became the Secretary of Treasury and jammed the $1 trillion stimulus through Congress in 2008. But at the time, he was head of Goldman Sachs, and he went down and basically jawboned the SEC to remove the capital requirements, which enabled the investment banks to further the lending or the selling of these mortgage-backed securities, so they could leverage themselves in much greater numbers than they were able to previously. All these things kind of went together. You have the Community Reinvestment Act, which forced the banks to make subprime loans. Then you have Glass-Steagall, which allows the commercial banks and the investment banks to get together. And then you have
the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
The repeal of Glass-Steagall. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then you have this lowering of capital requirements, all of which kind of enables this superhighway of hundreds of billions of dollars of junk debt to be flogged to banks around the planet, and that's how banks got pregnant with toxic assets.
How does this tie into Basel I and Basel II?
Well,
Basel II.
That's the hammer. Basel II, and Basel is named after, that name comes from Basel or Basel, Switzerland, which is where the Bank for International Settlements is. And they issued a edict called Mark to the Market. And while that rule sounds good, it says that banks have to, have a similar a pricing of their assets similar to other assets. What happened here is you have these banks full of this toxic paper, and Mark to the Market says, like, if the value of Lehman Brothers subprime mortgages now goes to 10 cents on the dollar, the mark-to-market rule mandated that other banks had to value their assets the same way, regardless of whether their assets were paying or not, regardless of whether people were paying the mortgages in these subprime packages or not. If this bank's portfolio sinks down, and Lehman Brothers was clearly taken down, that's another story, but clearly taken down, then all the rest of the banks had to value or devalue these billions and billions and billions in assets. When they devalued their assets, it basically wiped out their capital structure, and the credit markets froze.
So a bank has no sovereignty, really, in the sense of it's not an independent organism. It is ruled by this tyrannical organism, this other organism that says it has jurisdiction over everything that's called a bank, and whatever it decides, if it decides its value is shredded by 100 points, then that's what happens by decree.
That is what happened, and that's what Mark, that you're exactly right, and that's what Mark to the Market was and is. And when that rule got promulgated by the Bank for International Settlements, all of a sudden the assets of the banks around the planet that were holding these things, and Goldman Sachs and others, sold them by the hundreds of billions. All of a sudden their asset category is trash, and lending froze, and that is the so-called financial crisis. What caused it? What was the spark? You have all these other things leading up to it, but the spark or the hammer was this rule promulgated from the Bank for International Settlements called Basel II, which was this mark-to-market rule.
Is it true that the SEC has some say in any of this, or they have no say in any of this? What's the SEC's role in this whole equation?
Well, the SEC was very involved in this, Kim. Hank Paulson's jawboning of capital requirement reduction was with the SEC. So they just, God knows why. One can theorize, but they just waived these capital requirements, again, that had been in place for some time. And the Wall Street bankers, and Paulson wasn't alone in doing this. There were other investment bankers down there. But Hank Paulson, before he became the Secretary of the Treasury and got the Congress, meaning you and I, to cough up $1 trillion to pay back the banks, he was the prime salesman of subprime mortgages when he was with Goldman Sachs. In other words, he's selling the hell out of this junk. Now the banks are full of it, including his own. Then he, right before the financial crisis, he leaves Goldman Sachs, becomes Secretary of the Treasury, and basically browbeats Congress into this outrageous stimulus plan, which did nothing but pay back the bankers. It just paid back his friends.
Where does TARP come into any of this? I don't understand TARP, and I don't know how many people do, but what is it?
But that is TARP. TARP is the stimulus plan. That's the acronym for, what's that stand for? Troubled Asset Relief Program is what that is. And that's just the stimulus. That's just Paulson going to Congress and going, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. You need to approve. It was about $800 billion. With interest, it was about $1 trillion.
Didn't it end up being more than that, too?
Well, there are other programs. The TARP program, with interest is about $1 trillion, give or take. But he said, if you don't approve this money, the world will fall apart. The economic structure in this country and around the world will fall apart. There will be riots. I mean, I listened to one congressman on the floor of the House after this.
Wasn't that Brad Sherman?
It was Brad Sherman.
Yeah.
Exactly who it was, Brad Sherman, who had the guts to stand on the floor of the House and talk about the kinds of outrageous threats that Paulson made. But he scared these guys enough. And to this, you've got to, in my opinion, got to go to Congress and go, get some backbone, you guys. But just because Hank Paulson had been the chairman of Goldman Sachs, anything that comes out of his mouth is supposed to be golden, no pun intended, and they passed this bill. So, and the bill, as you may remember, your listeners may remember, had a provision in it that the sole discretion over this money was the Secretary of Treasury's, and nobody could question it, nobody could sue him, nobody could do anything. He was like, it was just... Congress turned over $800 billion of taxpayer money to this guy who was an investment banker from New York who came down to bail out his friends. That's what happened.
I think I saw something on YouTube with Alan Grayson. I can't remember who he was talking to, whether it was Paulson or somebody else.
No, he's talking to the Inspector General of the Fed, a woman.
Okay, and he was asking about what went into these payouts. Who do they go to? I saw one with Paulson. Finally, an answer came. It went into credit default swaps and other types of assets, but he wasn't allowed to talk about it. And basically his answer was that when Alan asked him, by what authority can you do that in an untransparent way? And he said, you gave us that authority in the creation of the Federal Reserve Act. I was pretty stunned.
I was presumptuous because I thought you were talking about another interview.
I did see that other interview, too. But go ahead.
There were both of them. The one was Alan Grayson asking the Inspector General of the Fed, a woman whose name escapes me, what happened to the money. And he kept asking the question in all kinds of different ways. She just basically went, you know, Congressman, we're certainly here to help you and so forth and so on. I'll have to get back to you on that. We really don't have that information to hand. She just never answered the questions. On the grilling of Paulson, and the shenanigans of the bailout are continuing to attract Congress's attention as we speak. There were hearings held last week on this by the House Oversight Committee, pushed by the minority member on there, Daryl Issa, getting these guys. And Paulson testified again last week along with Geithner. And they were focused on the shenanigans with the AIG, the insurance giant, whereby the Federal Reserve coughed up this money to AIG, and AIG paid the investment bankers back in a very sleazy deal. And that investigation is still going on. But the interview that you're talking about, you're right. I'm not sure who it was.
It was Alan Grayson who was talking to Henry Paulson. But I will tell you one thing that was funny. Henry Paulson was actually very polite, even though he said it's none of your blank business. In the meta communication, was it's none of your F business. The overt communication was you gave us that authority when the Federal Reserve Act was created. In other words, we don't have to answer to you. But my other question to you is, which is not in your book, but I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you feel like spending a couple minutes on this. Do you think that the AAA credit rating mechanism, that the credit rating companies also need to go through a different level of transparency? Because there were some leaks in 2009 that there was payoffs and shenanigans with the credit rating agencies. Are we supposed to believe that the credit rating agencies are also pure?
Well, clearly these guys were part of the problem.
Because that's a way to monetize an economy, is to invoke a AAA credit rating.
Well here's what happened. Yes, you're right. Here's what happened. The banks, and I'm using Goldman here, but other banks did it, but Goldman did it the most, I think, in terms of the numbers. They package up these subprime mortgages because of the Community Reinvestment Act. You've got all these mortgages from low-income people and folks that can't afford to pay for the mortgages. They get packaged up. They are called, collateralized debt obligations. The investment banks get hold of them, and now they're going to sell them to banks. They're going to just turn around and sell them back to banks. To do that, they go to an insurance company, AIG, and they get something called a credit default swap, which is a big, fancy-sounding name, which is essentially insurance, insuring the bank that if the loans in the subprime mortgage package go bad, that the insurance company will pay the bank.
Why would the insurance company do it?
Because they made big fees when they issued the insurance. They charge Goldman Sachs money to provide the insurance. Goldman Sachs now takes the package. They put their fees on it, and they sell it to the bank. But my point in all of this is that as soon as AIG, which at the time was the largest insurance company in the world, issued insurance, technically it wasn't insurance, but for practical purposes, They said it wasn't insurance. Regardless, it acted like insurance. And when AIG said, okay, good, well, if the subprime mortgages go bad or the mortgage-backed securities go bad, you're covered. We're issuing insurance that will cover you. Well, when AIG issued the insurance on the mortgage-backed securities, the credit rating agencies then went, oh, we'll give it a AAA rating. And so when Goldman Sachs is selling it, they say to the bank they're selling it to, oh, it's got a AAA rating. Well, the rating agencies had their conflicts of interest. AIG was just making billions of dollars in fees doing this, paying no attention to the fact that they could get stung. And when they weren't technically, when these insurance policies weren't technically insurance, that meant they didn't have to have reserves to cover their bets. And that's how those three are related.
The credit rating agencies then, in effect, that are involved in this type of action or activity are in collusion with something that's truly criminal.
Well, look, if they're actually going to rate something, Kim, I mean, and do it honestly with integrity, they would have looked at these things to see the garbage that was in them, and they would have never given them AAA ratings. And they would have looked at what AIG was doing, and they would never have given them AAA ratings. So from my perspective, they are clearly complicit in this mess.
And what do they get out of it, the credit rating agencies? They just want to be in the game so bad and make so much money that they'll play their role?
That's right. Money. Fees. It's all about money. It's all about greed. They get paid. AIG gets paid. The investment bank gets paid. The bank gets these things. And when they start to have trouble, Paulson leaves Goldman Sachs, comes to government under Bush, forces $1 trillion from the taxpayers, and then just pays the banks back. This thing was nothing other, if you back up from it a little bit, was simply a transfer of about $1 trillion from U.S. taxpayers to the banks on Wall Street. When you take all the this's and that's out of it, that's what occurred, bottom line. Outrageous.
Let's talk about derivatives. It's another painful subject. I just want to give a few minutes to this. We know that they're considered weapons of mass destruction in finance. But what are they?
A derivative is a term that has grown up in the investment community over the last, I don't know how many years. When I was an active banker, I'd never heard the term. So they've become investment vehicles over the last several years. A derivative basically means that it is an instrument which embraces some asset underneath it. So let me give you an example. If you were going to buy 100 ounces of gold and you went to a precious metals broker and you bought the 100 ounces of gold and you'd have the gold, you're just buying the gold. But you can go to the commodities exchange and you can buy a contract for 100 ounces of gold, and now you have a derivative. That just simply means that the power of the asset of that contract is derived from the gold itself. But you don't own the gold. You own the contract. That's the difference, and that's why it's a derivative. In other words, the contract derives its asset value from the underlying asset. That's what a derivative is.
Doesn't that represent the whole futures market and commodities then?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. But in addition, and why that term has come to the public consciousness of late, is because the subprime mortgages were packaged up as securities, like a stock or a bond, and sold. And so they were called derivatives because the asset value is the actual mortgages, but you didn't own the mortgages, you're buying the package of mortgages, and so that's why they're derivatives.
Very complex matrix.
Derivatives, that's right.
Very complex matrix.
Yeah. Was that understandable?
Yes.
Okay.
But very complex.
Yeah.
I can see why the average person is not involved in it, doesn't understand it, doesn't talk about it, and even when they get their contracts, doesn't really understand what they're dealing with, except there's a distinction between what is an asset and a derivative thereof, which is simply a piece of paper.
Well, you're exactly right. And the truth is, at the bottom of a lot of that, you really hit one of the key nails on the head. At the bottom of this mess is simply people that don't understand, and this includes congressmen. I've sat there and watched on C-SPAN going back to when Greenspan used to testify. And you listen to Alan Greenspan talk, it is psychobabble. It is, the meanings are ridiculous. Well, Greenspan was the maestro. He was this, he was that. And so these congressmen would sit and listen to him kind of slack-jawed, their eyes glazed over. But if you ever asked Greenspan what the hell he meant by what he was saying, it was just, again, to use the term psychobabble, it was gibberish. Big fancy terms like derivatives and credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations, these terms all get thrown around. They're just simply instruments, that financial instruments that get bought and sold. But when people don't understand them, they tend to turn away from them and not confront them.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember when I heard Henry Paulson talk about credit default swaps, and I tried to call all these people to explain it to me. And I did finally find somebody in New York and London, and we're doing an entire show on credit default swaps, nothing but credit default swaps. But I wanted to lay out a general understanding to the public from your perspective and context, which is more of a whole systems context. If you don't mind us switching for a minute here, the House Appropriations Committee apparently is of concern to you. Why?
Well, the House Appropriations Committee is one of the committees in the House, and that's how business gets done in the House of Representatives. There are committees that oversee taxes and education and health and so forth and so on. That committee deals with the appropriations or how to pay for legislation. That's what that committee does generally. But I was basically taking a quote from a member of that committee, and it's a powerful committee because it, as you can see, it controls funding. But he was making a point that was jaw-dropping to me, which was, and I should have my book in front of me. I don't. But the quote is, the concept of the quote was this: well, people are making a lot of money, and they shouldn't be able to keep it, and we basically need to spread the wealth around. And there's a problem with people who make a lot of money and aren't willing to give it to others. I mean, it's an extremely communistic point of view. And it goes back, and I'm not throwing that label on that guy or the president, but if you go back to the election and the famous Joe the Plumber conversation, when Obama is talking to Joe the Plumber, he says, well, you know, I think it's good if we spread the wealth around. Taking from the people who earn it and giving to the people who don't. So there are other quotes in that chapter, I think from Barney Frank, from this member of the House Appropriations Committee, all make it clear that there is an underlying tone in this administration that there's something the matter with people who make money. I am not defending insurance companies or banks or any corporate entity. But the idea in this government, in this administration, seems to be that if you're wealthy, if you're successful, then you have to give some of it to people who don't have it. And if you don't do that, we're going to force it. I mean, look at where we are here today, Kim. You've got the government owning General Motors. They own AIG. They're in the banking business. They're in the auto business. They're in the insurance business. And they want to be in the healthcare business. I mean,
healthcare and control
like
business.
Kremlin, 1974. Excuse me.
It's the healthcare and control business, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's another.
Yeah, but it's a part of it.
That law is the most Orwellian piece of legislation I've ever seen.
I agree. I just did a show on that this morning, actually, about the health freedom paradigm. The health freedom concern was left out of the healthcare bill.
Yes.
Focus and dialogue. Back to Gordon Brown, who really wanted a new Bretton Woods. Why?
Just for the listeners' sake, towards the end of the Second World War, as basically at the point where the Allies had basically won it, there was a meeting called in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, where the powers of the world at that time, and we were king of the world then, structured a new financial system. In terms of how currencies would relate to one another. I don't want to get into all that. It can get complicated. But basically, it put the U.S. dollar as the king of world currency. The financial crisis, as I said, was created to take the dollar down. and to take the U.S. down as kind of the king of the world economy and put these bankers in Switzerland in charge. The call for removing the U.S. and putting an international financial dictator in place, the euphemism for that has been a new Bretton Woods. And Gordon Brown has been a leading advocate of that.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Hi, everybody. I just want to take a minute or two and share with you that we really appreciate you listening and sharing with your friends and loved ones and colleagues. And if you like the show, show it. Write something really cool, really nice on It's Rainmaking Time at iTunes. We have our own store there. And like our Facebook page. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, feel free to do that. We send a bi-monthly newsletter out. And if you like it, share it with all your friends. Another thing we wanted to share with you is that somebody stepped in and started to do transcriptions for us. We have some transcriptions already done. If you would be interested, please drop us a line. We will be posting the transcriptions that are ready for sale. That's another way to assist the show. And for those of you who are in a position to donate $10 a month or $20 a month or more, please do so. Action speaks louder than words. We appreciate you, and thanks again for listening to It's Rainmaking Time. And back to the show. You said that on April 2nd, 2009, that the president signed some type of instrument turning over financial control.
That's right.
Is there a way we can verify that?
Yeah, by all means. By all means, you can. I mean,
how do we do it? Where do we look?
Again, I'll reference the book because the data is in there, and I've taken it and I've taken it from there. And
folks, so it's in Crisis by Design.
Yeah, the book as a quick promotional aside, that book is available at behindthewizardscurtain.com, behindthewizardscurtain.com. That's where the book is. You can just go to the Bank for International Settlements website, which I think it's BIS.org, although I right off the top of my head, I'm not positive of that. But if you put Bank for International Settlements in Google, you'll come up with it. And then just put in the Financial Stability Board. And you'll see there. You can read the press releases.
Is it a treaty?
That's an extremely good and important question. This agreement should have the status of a treaty, in my opinion, which means that the Senate needs to approve it, I think, by two-thirds majority. If not, one step down from a treaty is a congressional, an executive congressional agreement. Congress should approve that. But the president went and signed this thing and is just on his merry way. And I will tell you something, because I've spoken to members of Congress, they don't have a clue. So it's a commitment. It's a commitment of the United States to this rechanneling of our fiscal autonomy to the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, a rechanneling of this. And Congress is like, they don't have a clue. They have no idea this has occurred.
There was a lot of publicity about the IMF, many people at the G20 looking at the IMF to be the overseer of the global economy.
Yes.
And possibly in the short term using special drawing rights, SDRs, which I had a talk with Jim Rogers about that. I was under the impression that the special drawing rights were an instrument from the International Monetary Fund. Apparently they're not.
Yes, they are. Yeah, they are.
Were they created from them?
No, they weren't. the international, this is a, there's a lot of data to respond to the things you say, because you touched on four or five points, which I want to get to. But let me take the last first. SDR stands for Special Drawing Rights, and that is a synthetic currency issued by the International Monetary Fund. And I am here to tell you, and you mark my words, that this is the international currency that's being pushed to replace the United States dollar.
Right. They actually assert on their website that it represents a basket of different currencies,
yeah,
like three
right.
or four currencies. But that is so confusing.
Yeah,
how do you determine the value of anything?
I'm sorry?
How do you determine the value of anything if it's a mix of all these currencies and over the currency market? I mean, it's like dealing with a thermometer. It's mercurial.
Well, that's true. It is mercurial. And the IMF is pushing the SDR as we speak to be to replace the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. Going back to the point that you made earlier, what needs to occur is that there needs to be oversight and checks and balances over these guys in Basel, Switzerland, that are not international bankers. There needs to be a Republican form of oversight, and I don't mean that as a partisan word. I mean like we have a Republican form of government, meaning we elect people and they represent us. And each country should have somebody, you know, some little body needs to be there to have checks and balances over these international bankers, because the meetings by the board of directors at Basel, at the Bank for International Settlements, are entirely secret, Kim. They're secret. And governments need to have representation over this body, and they need to control it, and they can't be being having secret edicts issued out of some bank in Switzerland that nobody can get into or see anything about. It's worse than the Fed. So then the final point is, I think you were I mentioned in the book, I'm not sure that's what you were looking at, but most people think that the SDR was created by the International Monetary Fund, but a recently leaked or I don't think it was leaked, it was FOIA'd, Freedom of Information Act document from the CIA makes it clear that the CIA created SDRs in 1969. And that currency, while it's kind of been with the International Monetary Fund for four decades, is now, just now, it's almost like a sleeper agent coming to the fore.
What do you mean the CIA created it, like invented it, was the architect for it, wrote about it, studied it? What do you mean? I don't understand. And I don't know that audiences would understand. I just want to have a basic understanding, meaning if the CIA created it,
I'll make mention of the fact that the memo, the actual CIA memo, is quoted right in the book.
Okay, great. All right, that's fine. That'll be fine. So it's in the book, and if people want to know, that information is available.
Okay.
What is your life like now? What are you trying to accomplish now?
I'm writing a lot. I'm trying to get the message out, get this book and the message of this book out and around so that people, one, understand that the fiscal autonomy of this country has been co-opted and that there are solutions to it. It's not an easy task, but it needs to be done, because I don't think my life or that of my kids or my grandkids should be run by a secret bunch of bankers in Basel, Switzerland. And I repeat, and I don't like to sound Stephen King-ish, but that's exactly what's going on now. This is not a science fiction novel. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is Planet Earth 2010.
It's really shocking. Everywhere you turn. I had invited Dr. Betty Sue Flowers on in a few weeks to talk about financial scenarios, actually creating and expanding financial scenarios on a visioning level for the actual people that are running things, not just our own financial scenarios for us to expand our vision, but something that would include expanding the vision of what people are already doing and what agencies are already in control. Because I think that you were talking about another organism of consciousness and transparency and opportunity. And when you've been used to doing business a certain way, it's like that consciousness has a life of its own. And then it's difficult to deal with because it's expansive. It's huge.
Yeah, huge.
And it's like asking the identity of a consciousness that has mass to be willing to dissolve itself. So it won't be willing to dissolve itself unless it sees some other more exciting, incredible potential. And this challenges, as you know, it challenges our beliefs and our thoughts and our paradigms and cosmologies about good and evil and right and wrong and leadership and stewardship and what it all is. But I think that you've put together such a beautiful and difficult synthesis of understanding that it's well worth the read to have an understanding that it wasn't just subprime mortgages. It wasn't just the stocks. It wasn't just this or that. It wasn't one person. It isn't just the Fed. It's a global matrix. It's a global agenda that has been in the works for many, many years. It just happens to be that it manifested at this time.
Well, I thank you very much for the kind words. I remind your listeners, it's available at behindthewizardscurtain.com and as an ebook, and they can download it. And I hope the folks that read it and take action. There are some calls for action in the book, so it's not just complaining about something.
No, I like that, and I liked it. So you also advise people and help people transition their monetary capability into safe jurisdictions and safe investments?
Yes, I do some of that on a case-by-case basis. I have some clients that I do that with. I'm not in an office 9-to-5 doing that, but I have a handful of clients that I work with and on that level, yes.
And you're still doing the movie on this? There's a documentary coming?
We've got the company structured, and we put a LLC together, and there's a script, and we're raising money for it.
Fabulous. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been speaking with Bruce Weissman. He is the author of Crisis by Design, and you can find out about it and order it at crisisbydesign.com.
Pardon the interruption. Crisisbydesign.com is actually the site where the movie is. The book is available at behindthewizardscurtain.com.
I stand happily corrected, and you now have the correct information, ladies and gentlemen. And Bruce, I really want to thank you for being here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's rainmaking time, Bruce.